Possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where the U of I Opera Program presents The Fairy Queen, a Baroque opera by Henry Purcell, with period instrument accompaniment and dancing from the U of I Baroque Dance Ensemble. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Brush your teeth, pick up your toys, do your homework. Broccoli is good for you. When you say these things to children, how do they respond? On the program today, we'll talk with a founding member of the Harvard Negotiation Project about establishing rules in a process of negotiation that you and your child can live with. Scott Brown is the author of How to Negotiate with Kids, Even When You Think You Shouldn't. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Scott Brown. Scott Brown is the father of four children. After helping to launch the Harvard Negotiation Project, he spent 10 years teaching, writing, and speaking about conflict management. As president of the nonprofit Conflict Management Group, he advised governments and non-governmental organizations on public conflicts worldwide. He also now conducts workshops for parents on family negotiation. His book, How to Negotiate with Kids, Even When You Think You Shouldn't, is published by Penguin Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Scott Brown, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
Tell us how it was that you took your skills in the area of negotiation and dispute resolution with political leaders and labor leaders and began to apply them within the family.
Well, it's interesting. There were a couple of different facets of that question. One was I used to give large lectures occasionally to lawyers or business executives on negotiation skills. And almost invariably, someone would come up to me at the end of the program and ask me, you know, how I might apply these to their family problems or family questions that were the most difficult for them. And secondly, in the course of probably a couple of hundred seminars I taught for business executives and government officials, I would almost always say to them at the beginning of the program, you all have a particular style, a habitual process of negotiation, of problem solving that most of you learned in childhood because that was when you first learned how to get what you want. And you tend to fall back on that style or that habit when conflicts get very difficult or stressful. And so before you can develop new skills and apply those skills, you need first to understand what your style, your personal style of negotiation and problem solving is, and unlearn some of those habits before you can step into new ones. And it got me thinking that if we really wanted to be effective at teaching people to negotiate more effectively, we ought to start when they were young. And then finally, I guess the last and most important element was just self-defense. I started having children of my own and realized that I wasn't applying many of the things that I would apply in the field or in programs at home. And in particular, one case, I'd spent a week in the Netherlands with the two sides of the Sudanese civil war, and this was in 1995. And it was the first time they had been together, the leadership of the two sides, in a decade. And I don't know, I probably thought I was a pretty hotshot negotiation advisor after that, and came back home after being gone for a week, and I could not get my three kids, three at that time, in bed. And I thought, you know, who am I kidding? If I can't even, work out the problems at home with my own kids, what am I doing trying to teach other people how to do this? And so I decided I'd take a harder look at how to apply some of these issues and skills to the home negotiations, which are by far the most common that we all face.
Yeah. Well, as you point out, I think the parting advice at the end of the book is, knowing is different from doing.
That's
and
right.
You got to keep doing, and you got to keep on top of your game.
Exactly.
Did your family change? Did, you know, doing the things that you knew about in terms of negotiation and dispute resolution, did applying that within your family change your family?
You know, I think it did, or at least it changed me. It's hard, always hard to determine the impact on other people, but I certainly found myself thinking more carefully and more calmly, and also planning further ahead for the conflicts that we most frequently encountered at home. And we all have kind of typical conflicts that we tend to get into all the time. Whether it's bedtime or mealtime or brushing teeth or getting dressed, whatever it is, and sometimes it's all of those. And in the course of the negotiation work we've done with everybody else, I almost always said the most important thing you can do, and if we've taught you nothing else in this workshop, want to teach you the importance of preparation for negotiations. And that, if there's anything that I would carry over to the world of family problem solving, it's the same, in that if you think ahead of time about some of these problems, you'll be much more effective and much more calm at how you handle them. And the reason is pretty simple, and that is that what makes negotiations with our kids in many ways much more difficult than negotiations with anyone else is that our emotions are so strongly involved, and our kids know mm-hmm. how to push our buttons, and we know how to push theirs. And in the heat of the moment, when you get emotional and you're under the stress of emotions, we all react. It's sort of human nature to react with whatever comes into our minds first, and that's very often not the best way to handle a conflict. Now, it's difficult to prevent yourself from reacting if you haven't thought ahead of time about what else you might do. If you don't have anything readily in mind that you might do rather than your typical reaction, then you're going to react, as you always do. And so planning ahead can help interrupt those reactions that can otherwise be counterproductive.
Well, how do you do that? How do you plan ahead? How do you prepare to have your buttons pushed?
Yeah, well, it's always good to kind of get it down to practical examples because, you can talk about all the principles mm-hmm. all day long, and sometimes applying it's not so easy. But let's use an example of, one of the most difficult times for me, and I'll just use a personal example, was always bedtime. And I think because I was tired in the evening and I handle stress probably less well when I'm tired, as most people do, mm-hmm. than any other time. And if I ever snapped at my kids, it was almost always bedtime when I was least tolerant. And I started realizing that it wasn't their behavior that was making me snap. They were very consistently slow about getting ready for bed. It was me. I was inconsistently reactive. And so I realized that it had more to do with my state of mind at the time. Once I realized that, then I said, I've got to, when I know that I've had a difficult day, I need to sit down on the couch and send them up to do whatever they're going to do, whether it's have a pillow fight or brush their teeth, while I think about what story I'm going to tell them, maybe breathe deeply, calm myself down, plan on what I'm going to say if they are being slow, getting ready for bed, figuring out how I can handle that calmly and use a calm tone of voice so I can get their attention more effectively and not trigger their own reactions. And I found that once I did that consistently, I was much more effective at getting them to bed more peacefully.
Mm. So conflicts are going to remain, but maybe their frequency, maybe their intensity will shift a little bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's an important point to make. This is not a recipe for getting rid of conflict. Some parents think that, you have a lousy family if there's much conflict in the family. And my view is that conflict, anytime you've got two people living in the same house with different priorities and different sense of time and different likes and dislikes about food and clothes and everything else and music and everything else, you're going to have conflict. You don't want to try to create a household without conflict. What you want to try to do is just create a household that handles that conflict well. And in many ways, we want to teach our children how to discuss issues that we disagree about. I've had so many parents come up to me after a seminar and say, I wish my parents had read this book when I was a child, because even now that I'm 35 years old and have two kids of my own, I still feel like when I go to visit them that I can't talk with them well. I still feel like they're telling me what to do. They're telling me how to run my life, and that we can't talk about issues that we disagree on. We just never learned that when I was a child. And that's one of the main points of this, is that if we don't teach our children how to handle conflict and talk about conflict when they're young, then they will never develop that skill, and we won't have it as part of our relationship throughout our lives. And that's the relationship we're really trying to create, not one without conflict, but one in which we can talk about issues that we disagree on, but do it respectfully and do it in ways that don't upset us emotionally.
Yeah, and conflict with children, in children, their lives, I mean, it's a way of transmitting values to them in terms of how we handle conflict.
Absolutely, exactly. And there are many, many adults in this world who I know, after having taught many, many, that don't handle conflict particularly well. And if we can pass along to them some skills in managing conflict well, we're giving them an enormous advantage in life. It's a tremendously important life skill.
Mm. There's a scenario in the book that features a mother and her 11-year-old daughter. The daughter wants to meet a friend. Mom wants to make certain the homework's done first. Mom's tired. It starts. You know, I'm going out to the 7-Eleven to meet Jen. Is your homework finished? Well, quit nagging me about my homework. It's my homework. It's not your homework. Leave me alone.
Right.
And here we have an escalation in what we're arguing about and in the emotion that's involved.
Right.
Once that is set in motion, how do you get it back? What can you do to rein it in?
Yeah, it's difficult, because once it is set in motion, once the emotions are triggered, it can take a while to calm down, even if we do change our approach to it. So the most important thing is to prevent those things. I mean, we can probably anticipate most of the things that will trigger emotions in our kids, and we know most of the things that trigger our emotions when they say them to us. So the most important thing is prevention. But let's assume that they have been triggered. What can you do? In that particular, let's stay with that example. In that particular case, when you're talking about homework, you can say, let's back up here for a minute. I can feel, be explicit about it. Say, I can feel you getting upset. I can feel me getting upset. This tends to happen to us all the time when we get in these discussions, when you want to go out and I want to make sure your homework is done. Let's talk about this. What is an appropriate rule here? And the difficulty is that if you are approaching that discussion when the emotions are too high, then you can't have a discussion about appropriate rules, because your daughter won't be reasonable. But if it hasn't gotten too far, sometimes just backing off and taking a broader perspective can help. Otherwise, you may need to say, neither one of us are going to deal with this issue well right now. Both of us are upset, but it's important, because we are making each other upset too often. Let's set aside some time this weekend when we can talk about this issue again and come up with some reasonable solution. And frankly, that may be the best thing to do. Even if you let the immediate incident go, you can, we're interested in influencing every particular negotiation, and every one seems important to us, but far more important than deciding this particular instance on whether your daughter goes out before finishing her homework or not, is setting a rule and establishing a relationship so that you can talk about those and set rules reasonably. And it may be better to give up on this particular one, but with the explicit understanding that you're going to come back together and resolve it for the longer term.
Yeah. Timeouts can be good for parents.
Absolutely. I mean, we talk about timeouts for kids all the time, and often it's the parents that really need them. But there are a number of studies out on the influence of stress on parents, and in particular there's one that shows that if parents have had a stressful day in the office, they're more than three times as likely to get into arguments with their children when they get home. And, the stress that we carry with us affects how we interact with our own kids. And that's something important for parents to realize, that the issue, the conflicts, may be as much their own state of mind as their kids and the substance of the arguments.
Mm. How much time and effort do parents spend in arguments with children or refereeing arguments between children?
Well, it's a huge amount of time. Yeah. There are a number of studies that show that with young children in particular, that is children between ages 3 and 7, more than 50% of a parent's interactions with kids involve some kind of disagreement or argument or conflict. So if we're not dealing with conflict well, we're really not dealing with our kids well, because it's more than 50% of the interactions. And when that seems like a lot, but then you start thinking about, well, you know, from the time we get them up in the morning and trying to get them dressed and make sure they eat their breakfast and make sure their backpacks are packed and they get out to the bus on time, and they come home from work and we talk to them about their homework and we talk to them about taking their muddy shoes off, and then we try to make sure they eat. You know, I have an argument about snacks and what time they're going to be home for dinner and the meal times, and then all the arguments around bedtime and homework. You know, it starts to add up. They may be 3 or 4 arguments within the span of, or interactions with the span of, within the span of 15 minutes, all of them conflicts about the same issue, but it's an enormous number.
It's exhausting.
It is. And that's one of the reasons that makes the conflicts are so problematic for parents, is that we tend to get in the same arguments over and over and over again, and that's frustrating both for us and the kids, and that's why we tend to lose our tempers and lose our cool a little bit more often than we would like.
Mm. Negotiation expert and author Scott Brown is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of How to Negotiate with Kids Even When You Think You Shouldn't. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers. Phone lines are open. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I want to go back to something you mentioned right at the outset, styles of dealing with conflict. What are they, and how do we size up where we are and what kind of style we use to deal with conflict?
It's interesting. This is one of the areas that we studied a lot in just general studying negotiations in general before I started applying this to the way parents interact with kids. We found that there were a number of typical styles of conflict or problem solving. And one is what we call the hard bargainer approach, those people who kind of take a hard line position, give in very reluctantly, kind of stonewall, and tend to become upset if things don't go their way. The other extreme is the accommodator approach, those who think that the relationship with the other person is more important than any particular issue they're dealing with, and they tend to accommodate and give in on issues in order to preserve the relationship. There are some people, and a third style is what I call the avoiding style. There are some people who just find conflict so upsetting and so nerve-wracking that they tend to avoid issues as long as they possibly can. We often find people in the office who do this, and they avoid issues even though it upsets them. They keep quiet about them until at some point it just blows up. Those are the conflict avoiders. And then finally, there are those who are what we call more collaborative problem solvers, who tend to spend more time working on conflict and negotiating them, working on both the relationship and any particular problems they may encounter. And I started trying to figure out whether this applied to parenting styles as well, and I think it applies fairly well, that what we normally talk about is authoritarian parents are very similar in behavior and attitude and approach to hard bargainer negotiators. What we call permissive parents tend to be those line up very closely psychologically with those who are accommodating negotiators. There are many parents who avoid conflicts with their own kids as often as they can rather than confronting them. And then there are many who do negotiate well and talk through issues well with their kids, but probably not as well as we would like, and sometimes all of us make mistakes and wish we could do that better. Mm. In my surveys of parents and seminars, more than 90% of parents say they lose their tempers once in a while, or feel like they could often handle negotiations better or conflicts with their kids better than they do. So most parents feel like they could use a little help in this area.
Yeah. I would imagine people find themselves doing all of these different styles at one time or another. I know this is a kind of a, it's a useful generalization, but
that's right.
You know, there are times when there is no room for negotiation.
And, that's exactly right.
And there's times, you know, when we're in a collaborative mood, but, you know, enough's enough.
That's right. That's right.
We got to move on.
And that's an important point to make, that all of those styles are appropriate at some times, and that ideally everyone will have the skills to follow each one of those styles and apply them at the appropriate time. What we don't want to do is find ourselves pushed into a particular style or falling back on a particular style when another one may be more appropriate. And so we need to be able to have both the control and the perception and the judgment to know what's appropriate at what particular time. And certainly there are times when negotiation is not appropriate, either because there's not enough time or because you already have a rule about that issue, and once you've got a rule, you don't need to renegotiate it all the time. Even more important, there are some entire areas, I believe, that are non-negotiable issues. Health issues, safety issues, morals, family values, those are issues that parents really need to take responsibility for, and I believe are not negotiable. That, you know, you don't negotiate whether your child is going to play next to a swimming pool when she's only 3 years old. That's, you know, that's something that parents need to take responsibility for. On the other hand, what is unsafe for a three-year-old may be perfectly safe for a seven-year-old. You know, a seven-year-old, you may well leave playing next to the swimming pool as long as she can swim. So parents need to adjust their approach to children and their approach to conflict and approach to disagreements and give their children more responsibility for participating in decisions as they grow older. And sometimes that shift is difficult for parents to make.
Hmm. I imagine from time to time people say to you, I'm the parent. What I say goes. I don't negotiate with my kids.
Yep.
Period.
Yep.
Period. How do you respond?
Well, I have that comment frequently, I respond in two ways. One, I say, you may tell me that you don't negotiate, but I don't believe it. I think all of us negotiate in one way or another with our kids. And to some extent, if you're just a tough negotiator or if you just say no a lot, that's a negotiation. It may be a very tough approach to negotiation, but you're sending a message there by that no, that frequent no. You may be sending more messages than you think you are, messages about how much respect you're giving to your kids and whether they are going to continue to listen to you or work with you. But in any case, it's a type of negotiation. And more likely than not, you may say that you don't negotiate with your kids, but my guess is if there was a hidden camera in your house, you'd probably do that a lot more than you think. But secondly, and more importantly, I'll describe this response through an example. I had a young mother who came to one of my workshops with her parents, and she, because the grandparents often took care of her children, and she said, you know, I think I already negotiate too much with my kids. My parents just told me what to do, and there was no negotiation. They set the rules, and I had to follow them. And I said, well, that probably worked in your household, particularly when you were young. But what often happens is that if parents don't teach their kids to work with them and don't work with their kids when they're young, then the kids won't work with them as they get to be teenagers, and they tend to rebel more strongly. And her father, who was sitting in the room with her, looked up at me and said, you know, you're right. She was hell as a teenager. And that's what can happen if you don't teach your kids how to work with you when they're young. They don't know how to do it when they're older, and they rebel more strongly because they feel that you have not listened to them throughout their kind of young childhood.
Listening.
Right.
That's an important point.
It's very important, and it's very difficult sometimes for parents to do, because listening implies more than just hearing their words. It means really trying to understand their emotions and their feelings as well. And we're not kids. You know, it's been a long time since most of us have been kids, and we think we know what our kids are thinking and what they're going through. And so since we think we already know and already understand, we tend not to listen as well as we might. We're better listeners if we assume that we don't know what they're thinking and we don't know how they're viewing a particular issue that we may disagree about. If we assume that we don't understand them, we're likely to listen more carefully.
Mm-hmm. Throughout the book, you include some of the strips from Calvin and Hobbes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful because here we have a little character, Calvin, and the world looks real different through his eyes. And, you know, the artist really, he has the ability to see through Calvin's eyes where we sometimes, it's lost.
That's
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And, you know, I love the way kids think sometimes, but it does take you back from time to time. I remember one situation in which my son had asked me, I don't know how it came up in a conversation, but my wife had told him, I guess, that there were timber rattlers. We live in New Hampshire, and there were timber rattlers on a hill over in Vermont. So he asked me whether there were, another course of the conversation, whether there were any snakes in New Hampshire. I said, no. So he was quiet for a little while, and then he said, Dad, is that, we live right on the river, and you can see Vermont from our house. So I said, Dad, is that Vermont over there? I said, yeah, that's Vermont. He said, I thought, well, this is a great conversation about geography. He's understanding this. And then he said, Dad, does that, so that bridge over there goes over to Vermont? And I said, yeah. And then he said, Dad, can snakes go across roads? And then I realized what he was thinking. All this time, and this probably went, you know, these different questions came up over the course of maybe half an hour. All this time he'd been thinking about whether those snakes could come over from Vermont or not. But it had not crossed my mind what he was thinking when he was looking across and seeing Vermont over there. And you just don't know what's going through a child's mind.
Yeah, the world looks very different.
Yep.
Would you walk us through the steps of what you call persuasive parenting?
Well, yes, I can, but I think it's all integrated with the other steps, and we've touched on them, very briefly. Controlling your own emotions before you deal mm-hmm. with your kids is the first step to really being able to handle them calmly and get them to listen to you and set the tone for good problem solving. And then helping your kids manage their emotions as well, and it's important to understand that children are not born with the ability to manage their own emotions. They develop that only through the first 5 years of life. So if you have a toddler who throws a lot of tantrums, it may well be because he has the ability to stimulate lots of emotion and will develop, but has not yet developed the ability to manage it. And so you need to help him through that process. And there are several techniques that I go through briefly in the book on how you can help him do that. Then you need to listen, that we've just touched on, to understand how they see a problem, because you're not going to work well with anyone, whether this applies to children or negotiating with anyone else, unless you can see the problem through someone else's eyes. And then you need to be able to talk to, what I call talk to teach, to help them understand how you are seeing the issue. And let me just give you a brief mm-hmm. example. Marketers know well that if we put on a package of meat, 80% lean, more people will buy it than if it says 20% fat, even though it's the same package of meat. But the way we put things, the words we use, changes the way people respond. And the same is true with our children. We can say things in certain ways that will get our children's dander up, and we'll argue more strongly, and we can say it in a different way, the same thing, and they'll go along. So we need to be able to talk in ways that they will respond to and understand. And another point I make is that we often talk about how we need to, we ask our kids all the time, how was your day and what's going on? It's difficult to get them to talk. We need to give them examples of how to talk early in their lives. And I'm always struck by how little parents tell their children about what's going on in their day or what they're thinking or what their mm-hmm. emotions are. And when you think about it, we communicate with our kids very little besides telling them what to do and kind of managing the minute-to-minute activities of the day. And if we want our kids to talk to us more fully about what they're feeling and what they're going through, then we need to be comfortable doing that with our kids as well. And then finally, I get to the point of persuading rather than coercing. And I guess the bottom line here is that, yes, we want to change our child's behavior if they're misbehaving. Let's say they're not turning off the television when we want them to, or they're eating too many sweet snacks and we're telling them not to. We want to change that immediate behavior. But more important than changing their behavior, which we can do with coercion, we can do it with threats of punishment or with rewards. You know, after all, we can change the behavior of a pigeon with a few grains of corn. But what we want to do is more important than changing their behavior is changing the way they think so that they won't behave the same way the next time. And that's what we mean by persuasion. And if you're not changing the way your kids think, if you're not thinking about how they're thinking, then you're not going to be as effective at creating a household in which conflicts are less frequent.
Mm. Persuasion, then, has got to be part of discipline.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are a number of steps. Again, you want to, ideally, you want to prevent the situations that are going to require more discipline. And some ways of doing that are involving your children earlier in the process. I try to encourage involving kids in making rules. And sometimes it sounds to people like, you know, letting the fox guard the chicken coop. But I've found in our own family that if you talk about it at a time when the rule doesn't apply, if you talk about it on a weekend when it's a conflict that often happens during the week or whatever, kids will often be pretty good about coming up with reasonable rules. And you don't have to agree with the suggestions they come up with, but it's a good idea to get their thoughts and ideas and understand them first, because they may come up with some pretty good ideas. And second, that you can include their perceptions of reasonable consequences. And we do this with our kids by getting all four of them together sometimes, because if they're all together, none of them think the consequence is going to apply to them. They all think it's going to apply to one of their siblings. And they'll come up with more, you know, with stiffer consequences when they apply to one of their siblings. So they can be tougher on themselves than sometimes Mary or I would be on them. And so that, I think, is a good technique to get them, because once they've participated in the process, one, they'll remember it more, and second, they're more likely to comply. But in terms of discipline, and this gets back to your point, I do believe that discipline should be thought of as different from punishment, and we often use those terms interchangeably, but discipline comes from the same root as the word disciple, which means to learn, and if our children aren't learning something from our discipline, then it's not good discipline. It may be punishment, but I think of punishment as backwards-looking at what's already happened, and discipline as forwards-looking, trying to teach them something so the same thing won't happen again. And you know, the same type of activity can be either discipline or punishment, depending on how the parent handles it. And let me give you an example. Many people use timeout for kids for discipline technique, which some people think is good and some people think is bad, and I happen to think it depends on how the parent handles it. For example, if you see your 3-year-old son or 4-year-old son playing in a group of other kids and all of a sudden he grabs a toy away from one of the other kids and whacks him on the head with it, you're liable to run over and see what's going on. Now, one parent might grab the son aside and say, you know, I saw you do that. It's terrible behavior. You got to go sit in time out until you learn to play better. Now, that child may go over and sit in the corner and say, oh, you know, Mom's so dumb she didn't see what the other child did to me. He took the toy first. He didn't see him hitting me. Wait till I get back in there. I'll really whack him. If that's what he's thinking during the timeout, then he's not really learning what you want him to learn. He's thinking about how unfair you are and what he's going to do to the other kids when he gets back. On the other hand, if you go over and take your 4-year-old son aside and say, you know, I just saw what happened there. Why did you hit that boy with a toy? And he says to you, well, because he took it from me first and he was hitting me before. And then you say, well, you know, here are 2 or 3 other ways you might have handled that situation, and I still think you need to go spend 5 minutes thinking alone about how you'll handle that situation differently next time. In that case, it's essentially the same timeout, but your child is more likely to be thinking about how to handle things differently next time than he would have been in the first case. So one is, you know, backward-looking punishment, which can be counterproductive, and the other one is more forward-looking discipline.
Yeah, you can teach through punishment or through discipline. Well, let's say punishment. Let's not confuse discipline and punishment. But through punishment, you can effectively teach your children how to lie.
That's right.
And cover things up. And, you know, there are in that chapter, Discipline Wisely, in the book, there are examples of just that. You know,
right.
If there's to be no computer games between at a certain time of the day, and you know, that's the story that opens the chapter, David's playing the computer when he shouldn't be. And he is lying to his mother then. He's saying, no, I didn't. I didn't.
Right. And again, it goes back to understanding what's going through your child's head. And it's one of the points I make in the book. There's no one right way to do this. And what works for some parents with their children will not work for other parents and theirs. And you know, sometimes people think, you know, there's a cookie-cutter approach to being a good parent. And I really think that's misleading because, you know, what might be good discipline for one child will not be for the other. And you know, one type of consequence may trigger one child to lie or to mislead the parents and not another child. And to really know how to handle your child best, you really need to understand the psychology of your own child. And that can be very different.
So what you have in the quiver is going to differ from child to child.
That's right. And what I've tried to do in the book is give parents lots of examples of the most common types of conflicts we get into for a couple of reasons. One, because not the same, you know, kind of response is going to work for every child, and parents should have, you know, as many examples and ideas as they can to try to see what works. And second, to help parents think in advance about different ways of handling those issues so that when they get into an argument in the heat of the moment, they're not going to fall back on a reaction. They're going to have, it helps them prepare mentally, and hopefully during the course of reading the book, they might think, well, you know, maybe I'll try this next time, so that they'll have something else to fall back on when they find themselves in one of those situations and won't react in the same way.
Yeah. I can remember one summer my father grounding all four of us over a broken window. And my poor mother, she later told me, she said, you know, when your dad did that, he wasn't punishing you kids, he was punishing me.
Yeah.
You're grounded, you're in the backyard
for a week.
Yeah,
that's right, exactly. Yeah.
Now, what would you like to say about conflict between parents and what kids learn from how adults address their differences with one another?
Well, it's very important because children probably learn more from watching their parents handle things than they do from anything else, because they'll see whether their parents are being, you know, hypocritical or not in their own behavior, and that will have a profound influence on them. You know, there are a number of different ideas embedded in questions that parents often ask me. One is it important for parents to handle their kids in the same way, to be consistent? And my response to that is no, not necessarily. I think kids need to learn how to handle different people and different approaches in their lives and different ways of solving problems. And so it's not important necessarily for parents to handle their kids in the same way. It is important for them, once a parent has made a decision, that the other one backs him up and that you don't have inconsistent answers from different parents. But in terms of style and approach, not important that they have the same approach. In terms of conflict between parents, very important, I think, that they model these same ideas, that they don't get emotional and reactive, that they are able to talk with each other rationally and not yell and lose their tempers. Very important that they listen to each other, that they try to talk persuasively with each other. Very important that they, you know, involve the other person in coming up with solutions to problems between them, whether it's, you know, where to go on vacation or, you know, who whether you're going to move to follow somebody's job or not, or whatever the conflict might be. You need to work with the other person rather than arbitrarily making a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And kids are going to learn a lot from watching the parents and how they handle those conflicts.
Yeah. On This American Life recently, there was a segment that Ira Glass did with a gentleman who has studied couples and how they relate to one another in times of conflict, and they videotape them. And within the space of a few minutes, this man and his researchers, his fellow researchers, have like an 85% accuracy rate in terms of saying, well, this couple is either going to part or they will be very unhappy together if they remain together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, even if there's conflict and even if there's anger and yelling, if it's respectful,
right,
and if there's listening going on,
right,
and the sarcasm is put aside, you have a much better chance of,
you know, of, you know, resolving a dispute. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I think the level of respect is critically important in those studies and ones that have been done in children as well. And that's what parents, I think, sometimes forget. You know, if we used the same tone and statements with our spouses as we sometimes use with our kids, you know, pick up your clothes, you know, take out the trash, you know, you need to go make your bed, and tried that with either coworkers or our spouses, we would pretty quickly find ourselves getting into pretty deep trouble. For some reason, we don't realize that we can have the same impact on, you know, the reactions of our kids and their respect and the respect that they're interpreting in our words that we would have on anyone else.
Mm. And also, there's a nice example in the book, in the chapter on discipline, going back to that idea of the well-trained, polite police officer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he says, you know, you were going 85 in a 50 mile an hour zone, and here's your ticket. Please slow down and have a good day.
Right.
And then everybody goes off on their way, and the officer's done his job or her job, and the driver is, well, I was doing 85 in a 50 mile an hour zone, but he didn't lecture.
Right.
And he respected me.
Right.
And he wished me the best.
Well, unfortunately, I have to say that this is one of those examples that struck pretty close to home. I had, before writing this particular incident, had gotten two speeding tickets, one from someone who was very polite and very, you know, not only said, you know, sorry, I clocked you going this fast, and you shouldn't be traveling that fast here. And the other one who was very kind of belligerent and, you know, disrespectful is not necessarily the right word, but he just basically was unpleasant in his tone and demeanor. And I found myself feeling afterwards, not thinking about, oh, gee, you know, he was right, I got to slow down from now on, but rather thinking about, you know, what an idiot. He, you know, that's the kind of person who gives, you know, policemen a bad name. So I was thinking more about him rather than about me. And that's, you know, one of the things that kind of led me to realize that this is what we need to do as parents.
Yeah, I remember being stopped after rolling through a stop sign, and the officer treated me like a child.
Yeah.
You know, didn't we see the big red stop sign? And, you know, it's like you're, you know, speaking of, you know, your emotion starting to escalate, you know, it's like, you with somebody like that, you're just better off saying, I did, and I rolled through it, and I was wrong, and be off on your way rather than mix it up with a guy like that.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you're more likely afterwards to feel
what a jerk.
And, you know, squealing your wheels as you pull away.
Yeah.
Just to show them that you don't really take them that seriously.
Yeah.
That's the kind of reaction that your children can sometimes have, too.
Yeah. Before we go, here's another real practical problem. When you've got more than one child, or if there are a group of kids in the house playing together, friends, whatnot. Kids together, when conflict arises and a fight breaks out, your advice about when and how to intervene?
Well, I follow pretty much the same advice, and this is sort of, you know, carrying over from all the mediation that we trained. I think parents need to step in without favoring one or the other, because that will inflame the other's emotions, but to basically try to teach them how to handle situations like that, because, again, you don't want to always be the mediator. You want to teach them how to handle these issues themselves. So step in and with the same approach say, all right, use a very calm tone, say, all right, let's calm down here and let me try to understand what's going on. Can each of you explain to me what the other one was doing in a calm way? And try to get them to talk calmly about it. Then listen very carefully. Make sure that you model that listening, but also encourage them to listen to each other. Encourage them to talk differently. So you can say, can you put that a little bit differently so it doesn't sound like you're blaming your brother for this? Can you just tell me in terms of exactly what the facts were, and do you understand how he might have seen it differently? What you're trying to do is to get them to see that each one had a different perspective, and yes, there was an argument, but that doesn't necessarily mean either one was right when the other one wrong. And ideally, you want to do that frequently enough, and this is going to go on. This is a parent-long, I think you'd say it lifelong, but you should not expect this to have an effect within a year even or 2 years. You'd need to do this regularly, but eventually your kids are going to learn how to think about the situation from the other child's point of view and be able to handle those conflicts themselves, and then you've really succeeded.
Mm-hmm. Scott, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure.
Scott Brown has been our guest this afternoon. He's a founding member of the Harvard Negotiation Project. He's also the author of How to Negotiate with Kids Even When You Think You Shouldn't. The book is published by Penguin Books. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
You bet they are. Celeste from the Chicago Board of Trade, tomorrow morning, the USDA will replace world supply and demand figures. And traders were evening up some positions on the day, but they did manage to push the beans sharply higher, in the least the July contract up 11.5 cents. The November futures for the day were up 7. Let's begin in the wheat pit for the day. And they finished like this, 419.5 on the high, the low at 412, settlement price there at 415. They were down a penny and a half on the day. July contract, 426.75 for the high, the low at 419.5, a settlement price at 424.5, up 2 in the September contract for the wheat. That finished the day at 430 on the high, low at 424.5, settlement price at 428, down, or rather up 2.5 cents. December wheat, 437, the high, the low at 431, a settlement price there at 435.25, up 2.25, and the March contract, 439, the high, the low at 434.75, settlement price at 438.5, up 2.5 cents. May corn, 332.5, the high, the low at 327.75, settlement price at 330, up 3.25 on the day. July futures in the corn pit, 338.5, the high, the low at 334.5, a settlement price 4 cents higher at 337.5, and the September, 339, the high, the low at 334.5, a settlement price 336.5, up 4. December contract, 338.5, the high, the low at 333.5, and they finished the day 4.25 higher at 336.5 for the December contract. March futures, 340, the high, the low at 336, settled 338.25, up 4.75, and the May corn for the day finished at 341 on the high, the low at 338, a settlement price at 340.5, and it finished 4 higher. July futures for the corn, 341, the high, the low at 338.25, settled 340.5, up 4.25, and December corn finished the day 284.5 high, low at 283.5, a settlement price at 284.25, up 2.75 on the day. May oats, 177 the high, the low at 174.25, settled 176, up 3.5 in the July futures. 183 the high, the low at 180. Settlement price at 181, up 3.5 for the day. From the soy complex now, the nearby May soybeans finished the day like this. 10.28 the high, the low at 10.14. Settled just 2 cents above that at 10.16. It was still a 7 cent gain on the day. July futures in the bean pit, 224.5 high, low at 10.16. Settlement price at 10.18, up 11.5 in the August futures. 9.80 the high, the low at 9.70. Settled 9.71.5. They finished 7 higher. September, 870, the high, the low at 858, settled 859, up 4.5, and November soybeans up 7 cents on the day. 792, the high, the low at 783, settled 786. Once again, those noves up 7 cents. January futures, 790.5, the high, the low at 786, settlement price at 787.5, up 8.5. And the March soybean, 783, the high, the low at 777, settled 779. They finished 8 higher. May bean meal, 326.80, the high, the low at 322, settlement price at 324.50, up 270 on the day. July was up 270 as well, 324.80, the high, the low at 320.70, settled 322.20. May bean oil, 32.99, the high, the low at 32.65, settled 32.67, up 26. And the July bean oil, 32.85 for the high, the low at 32.53, they settled 32.58, up 32. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
It was a lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. Before I get to the numbers, I want to remind our agricultural audience that we will preempt tomorrow morning's pre-opening and opening commodity market reports for the testimony of National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice before the 9/11 Commission. We expect her testimony to wrap up by 10:50 a.m. At that time, we'll try to have a special agricultural market report looking at the release of world supply and demand reports and carryout figures for corn, beans, and wheat. Also, the special segment will be put up on the World Wide Web, so you can go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click on AM and then agriculture to find the link. That's WILL.UIUC.edu. Now let's look at the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Here are the livestock numbers. April, feeder cattle, 90.95, the high, 90.30, the low, 90.55, the settlement. That down 17.5. May, 87.85, the high, 86.70, the low, 86.80, the settlement. That down 92.5. August, 88.50, the high, 87.50, the low, 87.57.5, the settlement. That down 77.5. April live cattle, 82.35, the high, 81.25, the low, 81.47.5, the settlement. That up 7.5. June live cattle, 77.15, the high, 75.90, the low. Finishing today at 76.07.5, down 72.5. August live cattle, 76.07.5, the high, 75.30, the low, 75.47.5, the settlement, that down 42.5. October, 77.45, the high, the low, 76.75, the settlement, 76.97.5, that down 27.5. April lean hog, 63.10, the high, 62.22.5, the low, 62.32.5, the settlement, that down 117.5. May, 68 even, the high, 67 even, the low, 67.80, the settlement, that down 25. June, 74.75, the high, 73.65, the low, 73.70, the settlement, that down 112.5. July lean hogs unchanged today, 72.72.5, the high, 72 even, the low, 72.50, the settlement, again unchanged. May pork bellies, 107.20, the high, 104.60, the low, finishing at 104.90, down 205. The Dow down 94 points at 10,477. The NASDAQ is down 11 points at 2049. The S&P 500, 8 lower at 1140.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mrs. Omar from Bangor, Maine wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, last week at Thursday's bridge game, I opened one spade and my partner responded one no trump. I bid three diamonds and my partner passed. What kind of partner is this?
Well, Mrs. Omar, I'm afraid you asked a question science can't answer. For one thing, this is not a bridge column. This is a radio program about science. For another thing, bridge is a game of chance. Nothing scientific about it at all. All card games, with the exception of poker, are games of chance. If you're looking for advice, I'd recommend either seeking a new partner, divorce if the partner is your husband, or finding something new to do on Thursday.